You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Yes, you are back on The Wire. So, the US and Iran, often two countries referred to as being in tension. At the beginning of this year, there were some major instances in the heightening of those tensions between Iran and the United States. On the 3rd of January, the US ordered the assassination by drone strike of Major General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. He was considered the second most powerful person in Iran. Following this, there was relief as well as anger at his death. There was also shock around the world for what this would mean for Iran-US relations, which have been considerably rocky since President Trump removed the US from the nuclear deal signed in 2015 with Iran and a number of other countries. In removing themselves from the deal, they also reapplied sanctions on Iran that had been removed as part of the 2015 agreement. The sanctions, along with mismanagement and a shock rise in fuel prices, led to nationwide protests last year in Iran. More than 1,000 people are believed to have been killed. After the assassination, both countries were on high alert, and this led to the shooting down of a civilian plane by the Revolutionary Guard, who mistook it for a cruise missile. 176 people were on board, and all were killed. As the Iranian elections are upon us, as well as the American elections later this year, I thought it could be good to have a big conversation about what this all means. Negar Mortasavi is an Iranian-American journalist and media analyst based in Washington, D.C. She's been following Iran news and U.S.-Iran relations for a decade. I reached out to her to provide a bit more context about the history between these two countries and to understand more about how this political warfare, which could lead to actual warfare, is affecting the everyday lives of people. With everything going on, I suppose, and there's been a lot going on in terms of Iran-US relations recently, and generally our news does follow those main events, particularly political events and political statements. So I want to come back to those, but I wanted to premise this with a statement. A friend of mine passed it on to me. It's a statement by the university students in Tehran protesting the downing of Flight 752.
Mm-hmm.
I'll quote, "Today, evil flanks us from every shore. While economic policies and political repression suffocate the people, the shadow of war looms over our heads. What has been lost in the current political climate amidst ongoing threats from military powers is the voice of the people. The events of the past 2 months have been a clear and complete manifestation of the incompetence of the ruling order in Iran. Today, it is incumbent upon us to target the totality of our oppression, whether in the form of a repressive government or an imperialist power. In recent years, the presence of the United States in the Middle East has done nothing but sow chaos and disorder. We have long understood where we stand in relation to this aggressive power. Nonetheless, we also understand that US adventurism in the region cannot be an excuse to justify domestic oppression. This situation is made all the worse by the fact that a corrupt and totally dependent opposition has developed outside of our borders with the aid of the media and financial support of outside powers. Yes, today we are surrounded by evil on all sides." So that quote, I thought it just sort of points to these two key evils: a government willing to oppress its own people and a foreign government's long-term imperialist agenda, as well as the media, which creates and fosters a body of distrust and even hate toward Iran. So I kind of wanted to read that, as I feel it articulates that sort of complexity and uncompromising position that Iranian people face every day. And I wanted to sort of premise the whole chat around that, because I feel that that often is missed, at least in our media here. We don't have that constant kind of engagement with everyday lives of Iranian people. I just thought it could be good to center that. And I wondered, I guess, what you thought of that statement.
Well, I think the statement is a rare glimpse into what's really happening on the ground in Iran. You have this population that, on the one hand, is basically rebelling against, with very legitimate grievances, economic, social, political, that's rebelling against the ruling class. And that means political parties of all factions. The corruption that people are speaking up against is part of all the different factions. Hardliners, moderates, even reformers have been plagued by massive government corruption, the mismanagement of the country's resources, the incompetence of the ruling elite that we saw, for example, a symbolic result of it with the downing of the civilian plane. And then all of that in the shadow of a foreign threat, a very serious and effective foreign threat. And by this foreign threat, I mean economic sanctions that are impacting first and foremost middle class, working class, ordinary Iranians, regardless of their religion, demographics, whether they're pro-regime, against regime. It's impacting ordinary Iranians in Iran. As far as threat, meaning the threat of war, as we see in the student statement, that in order to counter the regime or the government's regional activities, for example, that a military conflict is going to break out and Iranian civilians again would be the first victims of that. Again, going back to the downing of the civilian plane, this downing of the civilian plane happened in a military fight between Iran and the U.S. Top Iranian general was assassinated. Iran retaliated against the U.S. And then combine that with the incompetence of the IRGC and the military forces, they went around and shot down their own civilian plane. But the takeaway lesson, the most important takeaway lesson from that is also that the consequence of a war that hasn't even started, this is a war that hasn't even begun. This was just one little episode of escalation. 176 Iranian civilians are killed, many children. Imagine what it would be if an actual conflict breaks out. And I think that's the fear that we hear from this statement. And the misunderstanding, or what they're pointing out at the media, is that when Iranians are on the street with these very legitimate economic, political, social grievances, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily asking for a way out in the form of another Iraq or another Syria. That's something that you hear from a lot of people on the ground, that that's also not the alternative that they envision. But at the same time, they have these grievances against the ruling elite and have been protesting for it in the past months, the past years. And it's something that's ongoing and the grievances are still there despite the brutal pressure and the crackdown.
To come back to that, like you say, this is, I suppose, all happening within a context, right? And these escalations were sort of a small part of a wider, longer, very long history. Would you be able to sort of give some context, I guess, to last century?
Sure. So I can unpack two periods. The entire period of U.S.-Iran standoff, which actually doesn't go back to 1979, but to 1953, where a coup d'etat was staged in Iran, orchestrated basically by the CIA and MI6. The U.S. and U.K. helped overthrow the Iranian prime minister, the democratic government, and they reinstalled the Shah, which continued to rule for almost two more decades until the Iranian Revolution. And then again, going back to the media coverage, everyone in the West knows about the hostage crisis and the list of grievances that the U.S. government has against Iran, the cutting of ties and no diplomatic relations until today. The second period is the very recent past 2 years. So what happened in the past 2 years is that a diplomatic agreement between Iran and the U.S., the first of its kind, in fact, the historic one, the nuclear deal, which was the basis of any meaningful diplomacy or peace process as an alternative to military conflict and war. This Iran nuclear deal, which was negotiated after years, cut in 2015, it was multilateral, by the way, it wasn't just between Iran and the U.S., P5 plus one or world powers, Russia, China, three European powers, U.K., France, Germany, the EU observed all of it, and of course the U.S. and Iran. President Trump, 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, completely without any basis, because Iran was abiding by its commitments to this specific nuclear deal, he pulled out of the deal, or from the views of Tehran, violated the deal, reimposed sanctions that were lifted after the deal was signed. And basically Iran, under that deal, agreed to contain its nuclear program, to make sure that international observers can go in, a very intrusive monitoring system to make sure that Iran's nuclear program stays civilian and it doesn't move towards making a nuclear bomb. President Trump pulled out of that deal, and in the past 2 years since that has been downhill ever since. He promised that he's going to cut a better deal because this is the worst deal and he's such a great deal maker. But what we've seen in the past 2 years, this recent episode, is just an escalation that's pushing the two countries from both sides really towards the brink of war. I would say they're standing on the brink of war. It seems like none of the two sides, at least leadership, top leadership, wants a full-on war. Iranians understandably don't want a war with the U.S., with the strongest military in the world, and the U.S. side and President Trump and his supporters here in the U.S. and the general public understand how another war in the Middle East would be catastrophic. But then at the same time, these escalations, these episodes of escalations, like the Iranian general or Iranians attacking U.S. embassy in Iraq, or Iranian-supported militia in Iraq attacking U.S. forces, the same with the U.S. basically the provocations of the past few months have just become very dangerous. And although the two sides have been careful to not start the full-on war, I think it's just standing on the brink of it, and miscalculations or any escalations, minor escalations, can turn into something bigger and get out of hand and just be very dangerous for not only Iran and the U.S., but for the entire region. And again, going back to the student statement in Iran, the first victims of any such conflict are going to be Iranian civilians.
I want to come back to that too, in terms of, like you say, the first victims will be Iranian citizens. I just, staying on Trump, I suppose, and the deal, he's sort of seemingly pulled out of this, or even evidentially unprovoked in a way. And you're saying he wants to cut a better deal, but I feel like, is this even about the deal? And what was John Bolton's role in all of this?
Well, again, there's this bigger picture of, because here in Washington, the mainstream view on Iran is a very hawkish one, from center Democrats all the way to hardcore Republicans, that Iran needs to be contained, Iran needs to be put under pressure. And that diplomatic opening under the Iran nuclear deal was actually a rare instance in the past four decades of hostilities between the two countries. So, and then going, as you said, the unprovoked pulling out of the deal, we have to remember it's not just the Iranians who are upset at President Trump pulling out of the deal. His own, the U.S.'s own closest partners in Europe, France, U.K. and Germany, publicly advise him, still basically express regret at him pulling out of this nuclear deal unprovoked, basically for no reason than to just saying he's the best deal maker and he's going to make a better one. His own advisors at the time, his own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, his own Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, his own top advisors, General McMaster, these are Republicans in the Trump administration who advised him against pulling out of this nuclear deal because of its bigger consequences, because it would put the two countries basically on a path toward more conflict rather than resolving on the conflict. And then also seeing the consequences of this inside Iran, what it eventually has led to is a radicalization of the political space, the more closing of the political space. Any kind of dissent, any criticism inside Iran is now going to be scrutinized and basically shut down much harshly by the central government, and strengthening the more hardline, the more militaristic parts of the Iranian political structure, and eventually weakening the moderates, weakening the reformists, weakening the camps in the political structure that wanted better relations with the world, that wanted engagement with the West, that basically negotiated with the U.S. and cut this deal. What President Trump's pulling out of the deal has done is to just weaken that camp, strengthen the hardliners, and then the two hawkish camps in Tehran and in Washington have been moving towards a more confrontational destiny. The Washington camp calls it maximum pressure. The Tehran camp calls it maximum resistance in the face of maximum pressure. And I don't think it's going to change anytime soon, at least until the November 2020 election here in the U.S.
Okay, and just while we're still on that, you saying center Democrats write it to hardline Republicans, this idea of containing Iran, like where did this come from? And I mean, America obviously has this long history of trying to, quote, liberate people or whatever it might be through their foreign policy, or their justification being liberation. So where does this idea come from, and why has it not worked, I suppose?
Well, I think this idea of using sanctions and using force that's been used for almost 3.5 decades until, like I said, this historic breakthrough, the nuclear negotiations and the nuclear deal came under President Obama. The idea was to put pressure, to add more economic sanctions and basically every possible force in order to contain. And it seemed like that is not going to work. It's put Iran into a corner. It made it more aggressive in their region, in its domestic politics. And then eventually the breakthrough came with this diplomatic opening. And when I speak to reformists and moderates who were basically the backbone of these negotiations, of this engagement with the U.S., there was this hope in Iran that the breakthrough, this diplomatic opening with the nuclear deal or the JCPOA would be the first step towards even more engagement, even more openings and detente with the U.S., not an immediate restoring of political relations, which is something that's probably going to take longer, but at least to build on that diplomatic opening or this framework, these meetings that are set up for the JCPOA and the nuclear, this ongoing diplomatic platform to build on and basically arrive at more agreements to be able to solve the tensions. But that didn't happen. What already existed is almost gone now. The nuclear deal is on, as they call it, is on life support. And Iran started to also act more aggressive when it comes to the nuclear deal. They're slowly pushing the limits of it, threatening to leave the deal totally. And it's hard to blame them because the nuclear deal was cut in exchange for economic benefits, in exchange for the lifting of U.S. sanctions. And then now that the U.S. sanctions are back and the Europeans are unable to provide the economic benefits that Tehran is expecting, the Iranian calculation is, why should we stay in this deal if it's only a one-sided thing? And then eventually pulling out of this deal, if it happens, is just going to bring us back basically to skip square one and put the U.S. and Iran on a path to more tension and more escalations. And that hasn't worked in the past 3-4 decades. And I don't think it's going to work in the immediate future either.
While we're there too, in terms of sanctions, what has this meant for people in Iran long term? There's obviously been sanctions that have been in place for decades, but you've also, like you said, had the increased sanctions over the past 2 years after prior to that having lessened sanctions. So what does this mean for people in the day-to-day? I saw you mention on Twitter the recent packages of medicine through humanitarian aid, but we're also talking, for example, airplanes not being able to be updated because of sanctions. So how does this actually work?
So as you said, Iranians have been living under U.S. sanctions almost since the beginning of the Islamic Republic after the 1979 revolution. The intensity has been slowly increased. Again, there was a small opening window after the nuclear deal was cut, and there was a lot of hope in Iran for more economic opening, for more opportunities, more foreign investment, which isn't just an economic thing. It's also political. It's also social. When you have Western countries, Western firms, even American companies coming into the country or investing, they don't just bring money and industries. They also bring a certain culture, a certain political opening. And there was a lot of hope, at least among the younger population, for all of that to happen, which unraveled with the pulling out of the nuclear deal. I also must mention that Iran is a very young population. Almost 70% of the population is under the age of 40 because the baby boomers generation was in the 1980s. So right now they're coming of age and they were looking forward to this opening to the world and basically coming out of almost a decade of isolation, economic, political, social isolation. The past 2 years, the intensification of economic sanctions, financial, banking, all of that has direct effects. And of course, it goes hand in hand with the corruption in the country, with the mismanagement, the incompetence, but it has direct effects on inflation, very high inflation rates, on employment. There's very high unemployment rates, especially for the youth. It affects certain industries that basically go out of business or completely move out of the country or have to be put on a halt because of the impact of sanctions on import, export, and all of that. And then there's also unintended or at least unspoken consequences of it. So, for example, the U.S. government always maintains that food and medicine and humanitarian items are not covered in sanctions. And on paper, legally, that's true. There's actually exemptions for food and medicine. But what happens in practice is that the financial sanctions, the banking sanctions, because at the end of the day, medicine is a commodity. You have to pick it up from a place and ship it to a different place. The financial sanctions, the banking sanctions have made it almost impossible for some of these transactions for medicine. So, for example, no bank is willing to do the transactions necessary for the import of medicine. And it impacts a specific area of the drug market. It's life-saving medicine, specialized medicine that the Iranians can't really produce in the country because on some lower level or a low complexity drug market, Iran is actually very self-sufficient. But when it comes to cancer medication, when it comes to special diseases like MS, there's certain type of medicine that's only produced in the West, in Europe, in the US, and the access to that has been very much either limited or cut. There's shortage of these medicine, and even for people who can find them, there's a much increase in price, and that has created a humanitarian situation for those people with special diseases. We saw the opening with a Swiss channel of basically a humanitarian channel, where by humanitarian, it means that it's a trade. It's an actual trade. Iranians pay for medicine to Switzerland, and the Swiss sell them the medicine, but it has to be transferred through a channel because of the pressure of U.S. sanctions. And it's so basically, it's been very late under so much pressure, and it's not going to answer the demand that's in the market. But it's a very good opening. It's a good opening that eventually happened under pressure, and I hope more of this comes. But just the intended consequences of sanctions, which is putting more pressure on the population, as we've heard from U.S. officials. We heard from Secretary of State Pompeo saying that the Iranian regime has to decide if it wants its people to eat or not, basically saying that the consequence of this sanction is going to be on the Iranian population as a pressure to then pressure the regime. And then also the unspoken consequences, like the impact on medicine and certain type of agricultural products and humanitarian. When I say humanitarian assistance, for example, when there's an earthquake in Iran or where there's a flood, there's a big population of Iranian diaspora basically living outside of the country, and many of them couldn't even transfer money or aid back home because of the consequences of U.S. sanctions. So it has a very broad web of these results on the population. And then finally, going back again to the government, one of the contributing factors to the internal corruption of Iran is also sanctions, because of this, what Iranians called economic blockade on their main commodity, which is oil and gas. Iranian state has to rely on non-state actors to basically help them circumvent U.S. sanctions and facilitate exports of their oil. So you'll find these supposedly private citizens or private entities who are basically acting as the middlemen only to help the state circumvent sanctions. And that's the exact breeding ground for corruption, because the transactions are non-transparent. They're not open. They're in fact designed to basically circumvent a process, and by design, it's the breeding ground. And a lot of basically large sums of money are transferred in that, and lots of corruption has stemmed from that. So sanctions not only don't help the internal problems with governance, it's actually a major contributing factor to it.
On a side note there, I mean, sanctions are used, I suppose, to, like you say, control other governments, and specifically in reaction to perhaps wrongdoing or other, whether it be corruption or genocide or things like that, right? So when it comes to this, and specifically American Iran, I can't help but feel like America has this, going back to that wanting to control Iran or contain them and that sort of thing. And is there an element of, I suppose, arrogance in this at all coming from America?
I think there's an element of arrogance, and also there's this, I think, unawareness that sanctions, yes, I'm not saying that sanctions have always failed. There have been rare cases in the past, for example, in the case of South Africa and the apartheid. Sanctions have worked in certain cases in the past, but it's not just a blueprint that you can copy paste in every situation and expect them to have the same exact result. And it seems like in the case of Iran, because of the complexities of the country, because of its multilateral relations with the East, with the West, yes, you can cut off Iran maybe from Europe, but you can't completely cut off Iran from Asia. Iran still has a big world superpower like Russia, like China, somewhat on its side. So it's very difficult to get the intended result from sanctions. And from the past 40 years of experience with the U.S., we've seen that it's not working. But it's just that's the preferred rhetoric, or I would say the easiest rhetoric in Washington, is to have a tough rhetoric on Iran. You'll never be criticized for having a tough rhetoric on Iran in U.S. Congress, for proposing new sanctions, for adding to the pile of existing sanctions, sometimes even re-sanctioning the entities that have already been sanctioned. And this is just a problem that's a bipartisan problem here in Washington. It's not just a Republican problem or a hawkish problem. It's Democrats, it's Republicans. And again, it goes back to the lack of political relationship, basically any diplomatic ties between the two countries, and this very distorted image of the entire country as this one chunk of bad and with no nuance. There's not much nuance provided here in Washington in the political space. And then also the lack of access of U.S. media to Iran contributes to that, I would say, black and white image, or this lack of nuance among the American public. So it's very easy to sell a more hawkish pack of, you know, legislation or sanctions or whatever on Iran to the American public, because there's this lack of nuance in the perception, I would say, compared to almost any other country.
Yes, and I guess despite all of that, and even when you understand or not around sanctions or how that works and why, regardless, what is happening is that people on the ground, Iranian citizens, are, like you said, the first victims if there was a war, but also right now being the ones who are bearing the brunt of these sanctions. So I guess fast forwarding to November 2019, when the protests broke out, I mean, huge numbers of people were killed, possibly higher than reported. Internet was cut for days. And, you know, this means, like you said, there's this kind of media shutdown or media blackout. And then also Iranians around the world not being able to contact their family easily. Over 7,000 people have been arrested during the protests. So this is, I guess, an example of a breaking point. Can you speak to how the people would be feeling, or what, you know, what happens now, I suppose, because these protests are also ongoing?
Yeah, so again, going back to the student statement, which I think is a perfect basis and a great start for this, we have to remember that it's the two governments that are responsible for the situation that Iranians are put in. Basically, this political fight between the two governments, and the Iranian government using the excuse of this foreign threat, of the threat of war, of the threat of being under attack from the world's biggest imperialists, from the Zionist forces, from all of that, fuels the repression and the crackdown internally. And then, of course, like many other governments in trouble, there's purely domestic incompetence of the ruling class. As I said, very high levels of corruption that those in power keep maintaining and want to continue to, of course, have access to those resources of power, the mismanagement, the incompetence, and the current state of economy, the current state of Iranian politics, even society, is just something that big populations, big demographics, basically, of the society are in one way or another protesting. And we see the state responding to that with an iron fist, with a massive force, with security forces directly shooting at people, with hundreds of people being killed in the course of a few days, with internet being almost entirely shut down in the country so that protesters wouldn't be able to mobilize more protests. But despite all of that, the protests continued. It was massive protests in almost 100 cities across the country, very radical political slogans against the establishment. Of course, it was sparked by a hike in fuel prices, but then it completely turned political in areas where there's also ethnic and religious minorities who've had massive problems with the central government in the past. We saw even more repression in areas like Kurdistan, like Khuzestan, where you have Arab Iranian minorities, Kurdish Iranian minorities. The crackdown and the repression was even harsher in those areas. The casualties were much higher. The number of people killed or arrested, still, as you said, thousands of people are under arrest. The fate of many of them is unknown. Many of them are probably going to be handed very harsh sentences, long prison terms. And it also impacts the political class, meaning the political parties that are considered opposition to the government, journalists and media that are considered independent. We hear worrying news of journalists or political activists being arrested or being called into court for sometimes a tweet, just a few lines on Twitter that is considered critical of the government's domestic policies and also its foreign and general policies. Of course, the U.S.-Iran fight is not only between Iran and the U.S. Part of it is, or most of it, at least with this administration, is based on Iran's regional activities, Iran's ties with its proxies in the region, Iran's activities in, for example, support for Syria, or the ongoing standoff in Yemen, the Iran's presence in Iraq. All of that is would the government, the central government, or at least the hardline portions of the government, consider basically off limits right now for critics to criticize or to protest. Yet at the same time, we see the population coming out to the street, continuing to risk their lives to voice their opinion and also pay a very high price for it.
And I guess with that crackdown happening, this sort of anti-government sentiment in Iran would have been quite strong, I suppose, in that time, in that moment. And then you get this US assassination of Qasem Soleimani. And like you said, I don't want to diminish the risk that people take when they do step out and when they do stand up in Iran. And then you have this assassination where you alluded to a kind of increased nationalism and anti-imperialism in Iran. So this kind of flip, in a way, not for everybody, of course, but which mm-hmm. actually would have possibly worked against American policy on that, I suppose.
Exactly. So first of all, we have to realize the society is very polarized. It's wrong to think that everyone supports the regime or everyone is against the regime. There is very much very strong sentiments on both radical ends, people who are ardent supporters of the regime or the most hardline segments of the regime, people who are complete opposition to it, and then a very big population somewhere on a fraction in between these two. But as you said, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani basically turned the tide of a massive protest movement back in November, again in hundreds of cities in Iran, hundreds of people killed, thousands arrested, and there was this massive anti-government sentiment. And then with the assassination that honestly came out of the blue, Iran and the U.S. are in this proxy fight. They're on the brink of war, but there's no real war between them. So the way the assassination was conducted, and the fact that this was a top general who, from the viewpoint of many of his supporters, was a hero who fought ISIS, who fought terrorists in Syria and Iraq. The way this came down, it really turned the tide, at least for the supporters or people who were on the fence, I would say, when it came to the hardline policies of the regime. And then we saw the massive crowds that came out for his funeral, millions of people in multiple cities in Iran, including cities that had seen very raw, angry anti-government protests just a month before that, in November. In the same city, you saw millions of people coming out. Again, it's important to note that when you come out in support of the regime, you're not risking your life. You might even be awarded if you work for the government, and it's very easy, and they accommodate you, and part of the crowd might even be orchestrated or staged, but not all of it is staged. There was genuine protest, basically, against what was seen as a violation or as an escalation on the U.S., even from people who are considered critics of the IRGC. So I spoke to reformists from reformist political parties in Iran who are considered critics of the IRGC. They had even been pressured by the IRGC. They're called to court or went to prison for criticizing Iran's activities in the region. for criticizing the Quds Force, for criticizing activities of someone that cost them so much money. But they still went out to his funeral because they saw that as a dangerous escalation started by President Trump. And it basically helps the regime. It became a rally around the flag episode for the regime. Of course, not the entire population came, and we saw a lot of Iranians on social media who were content and happy about the killing of Qasem Soleimani. But again, the society is very polarized, and we saw many of the people on the fence or in the middle or critics of the IRGC basically coming out to rally around the flag. And then again, I have to go back to the Syrian airplane, which is what sparked the student protests in Tehran. The retaliation, Iran's retaliation against the U.S. attacking the base in Iraq, which, by the way, had no casualties on that side, on the enemy side, also resulted in the IRGC shooting down a civilian plane with 176 civilians on board, almost all Iranians, with a few Ukrainian crew. And that also, again, changed to some extent the tide of the anti-American sentiment that the Qasem Soleimani assassination had created. So now you have this very polarized pockets of the population, and then this very legitimate fear of a more serious military conflict, and then a glimpse of the incompetence of the IRGC that this is what's going to happen if a conflict with the world's most powerful military happens. This is how civilians are going to pay for it. Some of those people are actually Canadian, Iranian, of Iranian background, but Canadian citizens who were living in Canada. So this is a war that's going to affect Iranian civilians, even thousands of miles away across an ocean, who were just in Iran for a little wedding ceremony or for winter holidays. They don't even live there, and they got killed with their children. So I think, again, going back to the student statement, this is right now the state of politics: a closing of the political space, a weakening of the moderates, an assassination that was basically a gift to the regime that helped it as a rally around the flag moment, and then very legitimate grievances, political and economic, that are still raw, they still exist. With the brutal crackdown and repression, it still continues, and we're going to see more of that. But then at the same time, we have this upcoming parliamentary elections, which reformists and moderates mostly have been disqualified from running for. And we're going to see a very low political participation because of this anger, because of this sense of hopelessness. And I think we're going to see a more unified, hardline parliament coming out of the February elections.
I guess just to say, I suppose, on that too, that the civilian plane being shot down is almost a symbol, right, of what, like you say, what the students are saying, that the people will be the first victims.
Exactly. I think it's a symbol of how the internal threat of the own government's repression / incompetence and the external threat of a genuine threat of war and a military conflict, this is how the two of them meet somewhere in the sky above Tehran, where a civilian plane is hit. Why was that plane shot down? Because, as the IRGC says, they thought it's a U.S. missile coming at Tehran. Two missiles were shot at the plane. Civilians were killed in a moment. The plane had just taken off from Tehran 2 minutes before. So these things happen very fast, and they can be very catastrophic. And if the situation escalates between these two threats, the domestic threat and the external threat, it's going to be those students, it's going to be those civilians, it's going to be the working class, the middle class, that will have to pay the price for it. And not just in Iran, but also in Iraq. Let's remember, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani wasn't just Qasem Soleimani, it was also an Iraqi leader of an Iran-backed militia. So you have this anti-American sentiment now boiling in Iraq, Iraqis asking the U.S. forces to leave the country just a few months after very massive anti-government protests were happening in Iraq. So now what happened? Those domestic protests are taking a back seat, and the anti-American sentiment and the mandate of getting U.S. forces out of the country is taking priority over anti-corruption and anti-government protests. And this is going to reverberate in the region because Iran also has proxies in Lebanon and other in Syria. We saw protests in Lebanon also happening simultaneously with Iraq. Now there's going to probably be more crackdown, more oppression. And we even heard it publicly from pundits, from hardline pundits in Iran. I just want to give you one example that after the assassination of Soleimani, this hardline pundit was publicly saying that the rented mouthpieces for Trump and Netanyahu and Iran need to be shut down. What does that mean? That means any criticism of the activities of the Quds Force, of Qasem Soleimani, of the IRGC is going to be met with harsh repression, basically.
What happens next? What is going to be? I mean, there's this heightened tension, which it's always kind of been there. Right now, though, we do seem to be in this very, very precarious moment.
Exactly. So I think in the next big event, this is this month, the Iranian parliamentary election, and we're going to see a more shift towards the hard line, thanks to the hardliners, basically disqualifying their own critics from the race. So we're going to see hardliners winning, and also part of the population that supports reform, that supports the moderates, is going to not participate in the political process because of the protests and the grievances and the crackdown. So we're going to see a more unified parliament coming out of this election. The next big event is going to be U.S. elections, and by November 2020, I don't think by that time Tehran is going to make any major shift in their policy when it comes to the U.S. Of course, President Trump has been saying that he wants to shake hands with the Iranians. He wants that photo up like the one he had with the North Korean leader, and he wants to negotiate, but doesn't seem like a serious opening from Tehran's viewpoint, because the Iranians are saying, well, we're willing to negotiate with you if you come back to the nuclear deal, if you lift sanctions that you reimpose out of a violation of the deal. And doesn't seem like that's going to be the policy of President Trump. So the next few months until November, we're going to be a continuation of the status quo. Hopefully the two sides, although they're on the brink, hopefully it won't escalate. And then we also have mediators in Europe, mediators in the region, and also forces like Japan who are trying to somehow mediate between Tehran and Washington. So far, it hasn't very much been successful, except for one prisoner swap between Iran and the U.S., that the Swiss actually facilitated. But the rest of the mediations, for example, French President Macron had this plan of extending a line of credit, a big billion-dollar line of credit to Iran to be able to sell some of its oil in exchange for returning to the limits of the nuclear deal. That didn't go through, although it seemed like the Iranians expressed interest, but it seems like in Washington that was unsuccessful. The Japanese Prime Minister Abe has traveled to Tehran, has good relations with President Trump. He's been trying to mediate, but that hasn't been successful up until this point. And also some of the Persian Gulf region countries, Arab countries like Kuwait, like Oman, like Qatar, have been trying to play a role in the mediation between Iran and the U.S. or Iran and Saudi Arabia. None of that has happened yet. I think the maximum resistance policy of Iran in face of U.S. pressure is going to continue. And Iranians are watching U.S. domestic politics very closely, because we know that President Trump's Democratic rivals, all of the Democratic candidates in the race, have promised that they're going to return, basically bring the U.S. back into the nuclear deal and the JCPOA. So if a Democrat wins in November, that's going to completely change the equation for Tehran. And Tehran is going to wait until there probably and see what happens. They're now going to make major concessions to President Trump. And I don't think President Trump is going to change his policy of maximum pressure. In fact, it seems like he's trying to pile more sanctions. And then in November 2020, we're going to see if President Trump stays, there might be some shift of policy or some, you know, serious recalculation in Tehran. And if a Democrat comes, then we'll see more openings for a return to the deal, and then hopefully for more meaningful diplomacy.
This was a sort of question that probably should have come a bit earlier, but I did want to mention what is happening on the US border in terms of people being detained and interrogated, and then actually US mm-hmm. Customs and Border Protection lying, saying there was no directive when in fact there was. So, I mean, like you say, people mm-hmm. are being affected by this also outside of Iran. And I wondered whether this directive, I suppose, is it at all related to John Bolton's policy memo he put forward in 2017, where he was describing how to get out of the deal. And number four of his execution concepts and tactics was to develop and execute congressional and public diplomacy efforts, and one of those being end all visas for Iranians, including so-called scholarly student sports or other exchanges. So is that what is happening here?
Well, John Bolton is out of the cabinet, and actually he's on bad terms with President Trump because of the recent events with the impeachment. But yes, John Bolton is just a symbol or a representative of a certain very hawkish camp with a certain viewpoint in Iran, which frankly, Secretary Pompeo also shares very similar hawkish views on Iran. When he was back in Congress, he calls for bombing Iran. He was an ardent opponent of the nuclear negotiations, of the nuclear deal, and he believes in this policy of maximum pressure. In fact, more than President Trump himself, because President Trump talks about negotiating with the Iranians just to make sure they don't get the nuclear bomb, or just to make sure they don't continue their bad behavior. But Secretary Pompeo has put out 12 conditions for the Iranians that are even beyond what President Trump has ever publicly said. So it seems like his hardline view, his hawkish position on Iran, is a continuation, of course, of the camp that John Bolton represents. And then going back to the border issues, this is what Iranian Americans have been dealing with in the past four decades. They've been living, or we have been living, in the shadow of the U.S.-Iran political fight, which keeps at some episodes, it comes to the brink of a military conflict, and there's some opening happening, some relief of sanctions. But this is the shadow of the political conflict, and it impacts Iranian Americans. Most Iranian Americans still have family in Iran. They have loved ones. They have some form of ties. Many of them travel back and forth. And this basically era of sanctions has impacted not only Iranian Americans, but also Iranian students who come to the U.S. They study here as international students. And then with President Trump, there's a completely new episode with a travel ban in the past 2 years that he imposed. Basically, even if you're an American citizen of Iranian descent and you have family back in Iran, there's no way for them to be able to come and visit you. And with the very recent episode, this directive with the CBP, there's just glimpses of the Japanese internment camp of the World War era that Iranians are talking about. This is, again, going back to the war issue, this is a consequence of a war that hasn't even started. The border agency's officers stopping Americans of Iranian descent, their children, for hours, interrogating them, asking them very intrusive political and personal questions. What do you think about the assassination of Qasem Soleimani? Were you happy? Were you angry? What do you think about the current state of Iran and the U.S.? And one student even reported to the New York Times that they asked her where she thinks Iran hides its weapons in the cargo that's in the Persian Gulf. And she's like, I don't know. I'm not a political person. I'm not following the news. I don't even know as much as you know. So this very recent episode, and then with Iranian students who had valid visas in their hands. Remember, valid visa in hand means they've gone through very, very complicated, possibly the most complicated security clearance that exists in any government, months of clearance to be able to obtain that very hard visa. Many students actually get rejected for a visa. So when you have a Swiss visa in hand, a valid U.S. visa in hand, you board on that plane, spend a lot of your resources, your savings and everything, come to the U.S., get detained for hours and hours, sometimes even days at the airport, and then sent back, deported to your country. This is the recent episode that we're seeing. And again, it's a war that hasn't even started. So it has Iranian Americans worried what would happen to them if an actual conflict were to break out.
Absolutely. And I guess first, finally, to bring it here to New Zealand, I have friends again who were obviously concerned at the risk of impending warfare, I suppose, and especially the risk that posed to their families in Iran. So why is it important for New Zealand to understand and care about this, or just, you know, countries generally throughout the world?
Well, first of all, if countries have any kind of, ally, if they're considered allies with the U.S., it's going to impact or they are going to be able to have more impact at countries that are more distant. That's one thing when it comes to the mediation or any kind of pressure. If they're Iranian diaspora living in that country, it's going to impact their life the same way it's impacting Iranian Americans, maybe to a different extent, but it's going to impact Iranian diaspora everywhere in the world. Sanctions impact their transactions. If there's a flood, if there's an earthquake, you want to send remittance back to your family. You want to save, you want to send help. You travel back and forth. Again, going back to that plane, many people on that plane were Canadian citizens, Canadian residents, not in the U.S., but in Canada. They were Ukrainians on that plane. And just the going back to the conflict issue, if another conflict were to break out in the Middle East, it's going to have serious impact, not just on countries in the region, not just on Iran or the U.S., because of the casualties, because of the loss of resources. So many civilians are going to get killed. But look at what happened after Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan. The influx of refugees, that doesn't stay in the region. Many of those refugees are going to head out of the region to Europe, to other countries. And I think the situation, though, or the example of Syria, Iraq, Libya, all of that has really taught a very practical lesson to people across the world how these conflicts are going to impact them, not just economically, but from a human perspective, social and political, and then just further destabilization in the region, which is going to impact everyone, civilians in Middle East first and foremost, but also other countries that have any ties with the region.
And on a human-to-human level, you know, what's the best way that New Zealanders mm-hmm. who have absolutely no, I guess, understanding of what, you know, that real life experience in Iran would be, how can they be mindful of that, I suppose, in the impending or the possible impending warfare? But in terms of engaging with a media, I suppose, that is very neoliberal. New Zealand as a country is, well, I guess, allied to the US, but also very similar in nature. It's that kind of popular culture, all of those things. We're very aligned with America. So how is it that we can get people to actually be thinking about this more with more nuance, I suppose?
So I would say first and foremost, try to understand the fight or the resistance of the Iranian people, the real grievances that can be political, economic, social, and how many of these grievances are very universal. They're just nature, human demands for freedom, for democracy, for open governance, for lack of corruption, for transparency, for civil rights, for human rights, women's rights. A lot of these things are universal, but it's also sometimes easy to fall into a very orientalist lens when you look at these grievances. Oh, there's these people far away in this country who have these problems. Let's go invade that country to help bring democracy. Let's go, you know, do some regime change, the form that we've seen in other countries in the region to help with the grievances of these people. So I think the immediate reaction, at least when it comes to the Middle East in recent decades, has been that, and that thinking needs to change because we've seen that democracy doesn't come in a backpack. I think what people need to understand is not that these grievances are universal, but also that there are real serious movements, social movements, democracy movements, political movements on the ground. So these people, meaning Iranians, they have agency. As we saw in that student statement, Iranian students, the student movement has agency. The women's movement has agency, the political movement. And it's been going for almost a decade, this movement and this demand or striving for democracy and freedom has been going for almost a decade since the constitutional revolution in Iran, which happened almost 100 years ago. So this is not a new thing. This is not from last month or last year. This is not just Trump or the Islamic Republic. This is something that Iranians have been striving for. They staged a popular revolution for it. Many of the demands were not met, but it's something that's been continuing over the past century. I would say that's important. And also try to educate yourself beyond the cliche or the quick headlines that the media presents. I belong to the media myself, and I don't want to say all media coverage of Iran is bad or is wrong or is false, but it tends to be confined to headlines a lot of times, or it tends to be very narrow, just the coverage of government statements or government officials. This is what the U.S. government says, this is what the Iranian government says, and this is the nuclear deal. A lot of it is around the nuclear deal. A lot of it is around just grand scheme of these proxy fights in the region, Iran supporting Hezbollah or Hamas or the Houthis in Yemen and the U.S., Saudi, Israeli, all of that. But it's a very big country. 80 million people live in there. It's a very diverse society, pro-regime, against regime, secular, religious. It's a very young country. There's actually a very vibrant arts and culture scene. There's big sports movements. A lot of things that people who only follow the headlines get surprised when they hear about Iran or when they travel to Iran. And of course, the easiest way to understand the people or a culture or a country is to actually go and see for yourself. And as New Zealanders, I think the benefit that the New Zealand passport has is that the animosity between Iran and the US doesn't exist. So I believe New Zealanders can travel to Iran freely as tourists. Yes, the political fight with the West has created some problem with some of the academics, some of the tourists, for example, Australian tourists or British academics getting in trouble. But in general, there's a very interesting influx of interested tourists, not the mass tourism that you see at beaches in the region, but tourists who are interested in culture, who are interested to go off the beaten track, who travel on bicycles across the region, who go through the Silk Route. Because at the end of the day, this is not just an average new country. This is a country that has thousands of years of civilization. It's one of the cradles of world civilization. And there's just so much history and culture, architecture, that's worth seeing. So not for a lack of media coverage or the political fight, but just to go to a destination that's very interesting, of people that are very complex. And a lot of these beliefs or demands or even the political lines are rooted in very, very historic, longstanding cultural trends of the country and the civilization. So I think try to basically look beyond the headlines. Try to diversify your sources when it comes to Iran. So don't just follow your own country's media, or don't just follow the big name media. So for example, US media does a great, stellar, exemplary job on covering US politics. But when it comes to Iran, it has a very limited access. American media, American journalists have very limited access to Iran. So in that sense, sometimes you see more diversity in European media or in some Asian outlets who may be able to have correspondents on the ground in Iran, who maybe have an office because of the lack of the political fight. So try to diversify the sources of news, try to go beyond the headlines, try to connect people to people, try to find real Iranians, and not just diaspora, but actual Iranians in Iran, and then eventually try to go visit the country, which I think is great, and nobody has regretted visiting Iran ever.
Awesome. Well, I mean, that's all from me. Unless you wanted to add anything else.
I just wanted to add something about Islamophobia, which I think is also somehow connected to Iranophobia. So I think the trend, at least the Iranophobia trend that we see, which is a direct consequence of the politics here in the U.S. and in some other Western capitals, and then it trickles down to the media, it also goes hand in hand with the bigger global trend of Islamophobia. At the end of the day, Iran is a Muslim country in the Middle East. When we talk about the travel ban, essentially it was a Muslim ban. President Trump promised to ban all Muslims from the United States. Of course, when he came to office, he realized he can't do that in practicality. So he ended up banning a few countries, including Iran. So now you have Iranians, even non-Muslim Iranians, Jewish, Christians, or Austrian Baha'is, being stuck under a travel ban that was essentially a product of an Islamophobic discourse. And I think when it comes to that, New Zealand actually in the Western world has played a very interesting role in the past few years with the new leadership and the Christchurch attacks and the response across the country that was very, very exemplary. And it just opened a new window for hope and basically a new opening in the type of leadership that we saw by the government, by the political leadership, even in New Zealand media. And even though it's a small country far away, with the connectivity of today's world, it set an example of how things can be different, how you can deal with things differently, how you can respond to these things differently, even as a country that's not necessarily in the center of news all the time. And I think that's also a very interesting addition to all of this big picture.
Thank you so much. And yeah, I'm going to
sure.
The main takeaway, go visit Iran.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, nobody that I have ever met who's been to Iran didn't like it. Of course, we're going to point out those who've been arrested, tourists who are seen as spies, but just the general tourist population has had a very great experience when they go, and they come back shocked. They come back shocked at most of the time at what the image they had and what they actually saw. The idea of this black box of bad people will be completely shattered, and you'll see real Iranians, and that will completely change your perspective.
And that was Nigar Murtazavi. I do have to say, it would be remiss of me not to mention what is happening in Iran right now with the coronavirus. So on my Instagram this morning, a post came up by the user See You in Iran. This is an account for the hostel and public cafe of the same name situated in Tehran. However, the bio also states, voices from within Iran to avoid others speaking on our behalf. The post they made reads as follows. A new phase of disaster and isolation has hit Iran after the frightful news of Iran becoming a new epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, another critical point we are facing along the recurring crisis during the past few months. Firstly, authorities took no measurement to keep COVID-19 from entering the country, and further on had no plans to quarantine virus-hit cities. False medical advice, avoiding reliable statistics release, and shortage on health services are causing social chaos. Many countries have closed their air and land borders with Iran, and lots of businesses are on the verge of collapse. Low-paid workers have no choice but to use public transportation. Vulnerable women and children are working on the street and subways with poor sanitizing conditions. And yet there is no sign of the official support. The private sector, conforming to the rule of capital, have mostly found their business more valuable than their workers' health conditions and did not shut down their workspace as well. For most of us, there is no excitement about our New Year celebration, nor Nowruz, with no family or friend gatherings this year. It is hard not to lose hope and fight for the good, though we do not stop to depict our global audience the challenge people inside Iran are coping with these days. Health insecurity, unstable careers, political disappointment, and an unknown future. End quote.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.